Today's episode of Absurdity is sponsored by The Haystack. The Haystack is a voice for young adults in the Seventh-day Adventist Church that produces articles, music reviews, videos, and more. To check them out, go to www.thehaystack.org. The Haystack, life, culture, theology. Hey guys, welcome back to Absurdity, and I am joined once again by Tony, my soon-to-not-be-creditless co-host, because we're going to be making some changes to the website soon, and Tony will be listed on there finally. But without further ado, Tony, how are you doing? Yeah, no. It only took me, what, 50 episodes?
What's the word where you feel like not justified, but like vindicated? I feel vindicated. That's how I feel. That's how I'm doing.
Vindicated. I am selfish. I am raw.
I am really happy because Brooklyn Nine-Nine is back on the air. And I would like to point out that I am one of the Twitter people that went crazy when it was canceled and was like, somebody needs to pick this up. I'm giving most of the credit to like Mark Hamill and Sean Astin and Lin-Manuel Miranda, but I was also in that group. So
thank you, verified Twitter celebrities. We appreciate you for Brooklyn Nine-Nine.
If nothing else, that app has given us Brooklyn Nine-Nine, and I am grateful for it. So
it's true. Well, it has resurrected and kept and let us keep Brooklyn Nine-Nine. Absolutely. So, Tony, you want to know what's really funny? And we're going to reveal a little secret that happened to us last week. So last week, Tony and I kept having a ton of connection issues. And like probably for 50% of the episode, we could only hear a portion of what we were were saying. We were guessing. We were straight up guessing what the other person was saying. And here's the kicker. No one noticed. Or at least if they noticed, no one said anything to me. They just figured we were both on like a different page slightly and we were just trying to harmonize everything. But in reality, we were taking wild stabs in the dark.
I think this is where he was going with that. I hope he did. So what I would do is like deliberately say things kind of like on the other end of the spectrum from where you were. Cause I'm like, if there's any overlap, it's going to sound ridiculous. So I would be like, well, I disagree completely. Like I'm way over here. Cause I'm like, he definitely won't be here. Like I just specifically went to areas you weren't on the court to be like, just pass me the ball, bro. Like I'm making space for us.
Well, and that's actually, I think that's a really good point that you bring up that I don't think people realize is sometimes that you and I are arguing positions that we don't necessarily hold. Mainly sometimes it's for the sake of conversation. Sometimes it's for the sake of representation. And that line is hard to draw because we don't always say when we're doing that, but it is worth noting that sometimes our more extreme positions are not always our own.
I mean, I think the other thing is like, it's not like we kind of plan it out to be that way. Like we talk about like our process is more where we discuss kind of the theme, the topic and our mindsets behind it. But then when we get into specifics, it's a little bit more organic like that. So sometimes for me, like when I sense that you're kind of taking this kind of a position, I'm like, all right, well, let's see it from this point of view. And it's not like staged or fake. Like it's still very authentic to what I'm thinking. I'm just like, I wouldn't necessarily like it's a real conversation that we actually have had multiple. I mean, I think that's how we became friends is like because we could sit around Red Robin and just like discuss these kind of alternating points.
Oh, yeah.
But it doesn't. It's not hyperbole per se, but it's like playing the devil's advocate a little bit. Like we go to more extremes. I was talking with somebody who's a very, very close friend of mine. And it was specifically about the NAD episode. And they're like, you really came across as harsh. And I'm like, I know. And I felt really bad. And they're from Africa. And they were saying like, you know, a lot of these pastors do this, this, and that. And I go, no, you're absolutely right. Like, I was coming across to make a point. Like, that was more the emphasis, but you're absolutely right. Like, the people there. And I go, I worry that sometimes we forget that when we talk about these ideologies and concepts, like, inside all of us, like both of us, is we care about the people. Like we care about the people more than the concept. But sometimes you have to bring up that concept, especially when we're talking about like these big ideological statements that people are making, because they're forgetting about the people. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like they're taking the human element out of it when they say certain things. So it's like, all right, well, we're going to respond back in kind of that same tone, not necessarily at that level, but it but it's like, yeah, we're a little bit too, we sometimes go a little further than we would in real life, because it what doesn't sound good and what doesn't make for conversation is
yeah I agree.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I just want to echo. I want to echo that.
Yes, and
echo your
yes,
echo.
And yeah. Yes, and
no, I agree. By the way, Tony, I'm really impressed because for the last minute and a half that you've been talking, you've said two complete sentences, and I'm just really impressed because through all of that and all of like the random pausing and jumping, it made perfect sense. I'm really, really impressed with that.
I do a really good job of creating a narration to where nobody knows where I'm going, and then at the last minute, just like curving it so that it makes sense. And everyone's like, oh, yeah. I'm like the Christopher Nolan of podcast conversations.
Yeah, I really hope I'm very impressed with you.
I really hope he doesn't have a podcast, because then he'll be like, no, Christopher Nolan is the Christopher Nolan of podcasts. of Advent, I'll have to be more specific.
So there is, I'm excited about today. And actually, I think there's a good kind of segue into this conversation, and it will likely come up again soon. So yeah. just know that like what I'm about to talk about for the next probably 2 to 3 minutes is something that will come up again, most likely, because I'm interviewing two people that were directly involved with this portion or this part of my life when it all happened. But so if you've seen my Facebook or Instagram story over the last week, right, we're recording this on January 13. I think I posted it on Wednesday morning. I posted a really long Facebook post, and then I screenshotted it into my Instagram story, and it was an apology. And basically what it explained was that when my dad died, it was my senior year, a whole significant list of tragedies happened to me during my senior year. And then I transitioned into college, and like life was, I was in my senior class play. I was doing all the senior class trips and things. I was in dual enrollment classes. And the reason I say all those things is because I never had time to grieve. And I never knew I needed to take time or how to take time or anything like that. And so I never actually learned how to
process.
I never learned how to process it. And what ended up happening was, and it actually started 2 days after my dad died, before even any of the other tragedies had happened to me, was that grief manifested itself as dark humor. And it was dark humor as an attempt to seize control of my grief and my circumstances. It was this idea that I wasn't going to let something that I had no control over control my life and my reactions. If I can't control my circumstances, then I can control how I talk about this. And so it manifested itself as dark humor, because if I can laugh about something instead of cry about it, then I absolutely will. And this is an insecurity I have. If you ever try to compliment me, if you ever try to like be really serious with me, chances are I'll deflect it somehow with humor. It's just kind of who I am. But those jokes, while a lot of them legitimately in their own right and objectively were funny, and I hold no apology for the hilarity of those jokes. I have an apology for how I use them. And so I apologize. Basically, what I would do is I would make dead dad jokes. Like, I'm just going to be straight about it. It wasn't
really, 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 really dark.
Yeah. Really, really dark ones. Like, oh, someone's dad called them in front of me. They're like, oh, hold on, my dad's calling. And I'd be like, oh, I wish my dad could call. Like, it would be stuff like that. And I would do that to friends, close friends. Sometimes I would do it to people who I didn't know so well. Other times friends would join in and be after a while. And still two very, very close friends, I can joke around. Like Tony, you and in our group, we can still kind of make some of those jokes with each other. But the reason that I bring that up and I'm so transparent about that is basically what ended up happening was I was projecting my own insecurity and my own hurt and my own shame and guilt onto other people. So instead of inviting people into my own grief, instead of inviting them into the uncomfortable feelings that I had, instead I literally forced it onto them. And so I'd make this joke to someone, or I'd make a joke to someone, and you know, they never even gave me permission. There were a lot of people where they kept telling me to stop, and I would keep doing it, and until they kind of got on board. And this was not okay. Like, I'm not sharing this because I'm proud of it. I'm sharing this because I think we use social media and even podcasting as a way to talk about the things that are good in our lives, and I'm not ever fully upfront. And what made me realize, there were times where I would do it and I knew that it was wrong. I knew that what was happening was bad and I needed to stop, and yet I couldn't. And that actually sent me down like a shame spiral where I felt like I had even less control than I did at the start, because now I didn't even, I couldn't even control my own reaction. And, so made an apology about
it. I think it's the other thing is like, when you know that you're doing something that probably isn't okay, you can either like admit it and face it, or you can double down. And I think it was just too close. It was too raw. So you would just double down. Yeah. And it just seemed like when someone was offended by it, you almost got this like your posture would like change. And you're like, I'm going to keep making the dead
jokes.
I'm going to
brute force this until they're comfortable
you get
with
it. Which is a way of doing it to where it was like, oh, okay, you become desensitized to the fact that, you know, your dad is dead. And not like that all dads, you know what I mean? Like it's not over, but like they became used to the fact that, okay, his dad is dead. And to a degree, I mean, it's not like you were okay with it, but it was like, okay, this is kind of how you've managed to like work through it. Like, oh, okay, Becker makes dead dad jokes.
That was something that like what finally spawned me on to apologizing about it was, two actual stories that were told to me, one by a mutual friend of ours, who brought up the fact that she hung out with a former student of mine who apparently, I think, I don't know, because I never would have made these jokes to a complete stranger, but I think this student walked into the room as I made one of these jokes to someone I knew, and she was so horrified by it that she kind of avoided me the rest of the year, and I worked as a staff member. And so I never knew why. I never connected with her, and now I know why. So that was one. And two, I had a friend of mine who told me just last week that that people when people first found out that he was friends with me or that he knew me, they would warn him about me. They would actually straight up say, like, be careful because he keeps making these jokes or whatever. And so I realized, like, I think it's time that while over the last couple of years I've done a lot to rein in that behavior, I think it's time that I actually make a statement about this. Because there's no way for me to go back to every single person who ever heard a joke and apologize. I just don't know everyone who overheard something or who said something. So I put a blanket statement out there.
There's a lot.
Yeah. So there are. And like, that's not okay, right? That behavior's not okay. Understandable to some degree why it happened, but it's not okay. And it was definitely a character flaw and weakness in me, 100%. But the reason that I talk about that today is not just to be in line with that, or not to be in line with my Facebook post or anything, but it was this idea that I was projecting my guilt onto other people. I wasn't, my grief. I wasn't inviting them into my life. I was actually forcing them to experience it alongside me without their permission. And that uncomfortable, I don't know what to do. I don't know how to navigate this. Yeah, that's what I made people feel. And it was this idea that, what I feel, everyone has to feel around me. Misery loves its company. So today we're talking about, if you haven't guessed by the title, I always say that, I don't know why I say that, but, you know, we're talking about projection, this idea that in Christianity specifically, we do this a lot, but I think we do this in general, but that we project our own issues, our own baggage, our own sins onto other people. And this causes a ton of issues. So Tony, I've been talking for the last 5 minutes. Give me some thoughts on, on projecting.
So just so everyone kind of is aware, let's do our kind of traditional blanket statement of what we think projection is.
Oh yeah. So our operating definition for the episode.
Yeah. This is our operating definition for the episode. So it's kind of the basic standard psychology, or psychological definition, which is, projection is when you have an emotion or a habit or a weakness or anything that you experience, and you take that and you put it on somebody else. And that can be expectations. It can be romantic feelings. It can be fears. It can be, you know, I guess we're still acquaintances, but I had a friend, and we've kind of lost that touch, but like his mom was so afraid of things. She literally projected her fear onto him. And she's like, oh, you're afraid of this. And he's like, I'm afraid of this. And I'm like, no, you're not. Like I would see him and be like, no, you're not. Like you're afraid of it when you're aware that that thing is around. But not like I would watch So I don't want to get too much into details, but it was like, it was a very common kind of thing that most, like, some people are afraid of. Like, it makes sense. It's kind of a dangerous thing, but it wasn't something, it's like something that we all do. I guess I can kind of say, like, driving at night. Like, oh, he's really scared of driving at night. And I'm like, no, if you're scared of driving at night, like, I've seen you drive in the dusk. I've seen you drive at night. Like, if you're not paying attention, you're fine with it. Like, people who are scared to drive at night don't drive at night, like, at all.
Yeah.
And that was only one example. Like, a bunch of stuff like that happened. And it was like, they would say, oh, like, I'm scared of this. And I'm like, no, you're not. You're somebody else projecting those fears onto you. I've seen that happen with romance and romantic. I've done that myself with romantic feelings where it's like, oh man, we're doing this, we're doing that. I think they're really into me. And then someone else would come up and be like, I don't think they're into you. Like, I think you're projecting that onto them. But for the purposes of this particular episode, we're specifically going to talk about this idea of projecting our sins and weaknesses and fears, kind of the negative stuff. And it can be positive. We can talk about the positivity, but I think it's also something that comes from a place of fear. We project because we cannot handle it with ourselves, which is so apropos that you kind of bring up your idea of your dead dad, because you would project your insecurities and your coping mechanism with your dead dad on other people.
Can I just point out that you say that you said my dead dad as if I have other dads that aren't?
I have
father figures. That's correct. I think you brought up romance, and I think this is a really good one. You know the person I'm about to mention. It's true. We all have Greg King. You know the person I'm about to talk about, but this person, when I was dating her, would constantly accuse me of texting other girls or talking to other girls or potentially liking and being interested in other girls. And then all the time she would come back to me and tell me, oh, I reconnected with someone and I think I like them. And we're dating. Like, we're dating and she tells me this, but she would always accuse me of liking someone else. I think that was a form of projection, right? This idea that I'm projecting my own behavior onto you so that I can ignore my own. I think the other form of projecting was, I think we see this a lot with cheaters, right? It's almost like a rule of dating now that if someone accuses you of cheating out of nowhere, it's probably because they're cheating or they might cheat. It's almost a rule. That's how common it is.
Yeah.
Like, and so they're trying to find something wrong in you before, you find out what's wrong with them.
Or they recognize, like, you start to see, because that's the other thing, is like projecting is very rarely a solo event. Like, you very rarely have like this, it doesn't just come on its own. Like, there's other stuff. And so you'll start to see these false flags. Because you have like all this other guilt and shame and stuff. And so you start projecting that onto the other person because you start recognizing things like, oh, I've done that before. Why would you? And it's like, no, I'm trying to like plan your birthday party. Like, don't look at my text messages. And they're like, why? Because you're talking to this. And it's like, or I love you. What? Like,
yeah.
Why?
Well, and even on a simpler level, like I dated someone who, if she didn't respond within 20, 30 minutes, then I knew something was wrong. And it made me insecure about, like immediate responses to text messages. Then I date another girl later. I get into a new relationship and she doesn't respond for a while. And it's just because she was busy. And I had to learn, like, I would panic and I would freak out and I would treat the relationship as if I had done something wrong the next time that we talked, because I would project what my ex would do to me onto my current relationship.
Yeah.
And so projection is really subtle. It's really dangerous. It causes a ton of problems. And so what we've tried to do here is give a lot of external examples of it outside of faith, just simple ways that people can go, oh, okay, now I get what you're talking about. That's what we're hoping you understand.
Yeah.
So I think for me, projecting sins is this idea of what's bad for me is bad for everyone.
My weakness is your weakness.
Yes. Which essentially means that if I shouldn't do it, you shouldn't do it. And we see this in pretty much any man-made tradition. Or any sort of, I think music is actually the most obvious one.
Yeah.
When I was
music, well, yeah. And yeah, but I said music and food, but yeah, go ahead.
No, yeah, I agree with food too. Music is one of those things where I remember when I was sitting with some church members once, and I won't say where or who, but I was sitting with church members once, and they were talking about not liking contemporary music. And they were saying, one of them had said, I'd been to Elevation one time, and, you know, I just, you know, the bass and the speakers were so loud, my stomach was rumbling, my ears were, you know, it was so loud, I had to cover my ears or wear earplugs, all this. And it's like, there's no way that that's holy. And what they were doing was they were projecting their own dislike or distaste, right? They were projecting their own preferences onto the entire genre of music. And even outside of that, they would say that, like, there's no way that's holy, right? There's no way in general that that could be a good thing. That was their conclusion because of how it made them feel. It was the idea. So, and I find that funny because then I read like Revelation where every eye will see and every ear will hear the trumpet call of God when
that's
he comes.
That's a
right?
loud, like, it's
that's
funny.
Loud.
That one of the only specific books where it's specifically, or one of the only books rather, where it specifically mentions silence is in Revelation, where it's like there's a specific period of silence. I want to say it's Revelation 8. Don't quote me. I took the class. Like, you think I should know this. Anyway. but yeah, like in Revelation, there's a specific time of silence. And I'm like, yeah, because they have to mention that because every other moment in Revelation is this loud event. Like, it's, there's just noise happening all the time. And it's hard to kind of get that when you're reading it from a Bible. But like, if you actually go through the text and like read through it, it's a loud book.
Yeah. No, I agree.
And most of it's music. Like, most of it is musical. They're either singing or they're playing instruments or they're like crying out, which is kind of a, like, the way that I understood that and the way that it was taught to me is that this crying out is similar to the prayers that the Jews, like Jewish people even do today. Like, that's the culture, is to cry out in a song to God, in a prayer, like their prayers are sung in the Jewish culture. So it's like, yeah, like everything is this incredible, man,
well,
it is
and
Revelation
I wanna,
well, 8. I have my super, super assistant Floyd Harmon here. Yeah. Revelation 8 verse 1. Oh, I nailed it. Oh,
yeah, you
I
did
nailed
nail
it.
Wow. Well done.
I'm so proud of myself.
Also, thank you to
and
Floyd.
And shamed. Yeah. Floyd's the best.
We need to get Floyd on this podcast at some point, just for the sake of his voice.
Well,
The
only reason I haven't is because he did a interview with Disruptive Adventism recently, and I was like, I didn't want to compete,
gotcha.
But I'm like, we're going to get him on.
Yes, I would love to hear his experiences. Yeah. So I think I want to be fair too. On the flip side of the example I gave, I've seen it. I've seen people project their dislike of hymns and hymnal music onto church as well. And saying like, oh, I've sat in hymns and it's all creepy, or the lyrics are super complicated. And, you know, there's just like that just seems like there's no energy, you know, and we project our own desires onto we project them as something that is the standard for everyone. So I've seen it on
both
sides.
I can enjoy this.
Right.
Yeah. No, for sure. I have that. And I didn't project it per se, but I was talking to you about this where it's like, yeah, like I haven't been to a church service that I really, truly like enjoyed from top to bottom. I think in over 2 years, like it's been a long time. And like, there's certain things I enjoy about a service, but it's been a long time since it was like, man, that just from top to bottom was amazing. And one of the things that I was thinking of was like, oh, I get why so many people in our generation are like, nah, church is like, how can anyone enjoy this? And even though that's just a projection, I'm like, oh, I totally see how you can say that. Because you would immediately be like, if this is boring for me, how can anyone enjoy this? But someone who grew up in that tradition, would they enjoy those rhythms? And yeah, music is a great way to do that because, like, even in the non-Christian world, like, everyone has that. Like, I have friends who are, like, big fans of hip-hop, and they're like, I don't understand how anybody can enjoy, like, folk music or like country music. Like, I don't get how you can like that. Like, it's this, that, and the other. And I'm like, well, a lot of people do because it makes a ton of money. And then on the flip side, I've seen people who are like classical, and they're just like, I just can't stand, like, you know, a dubstep. I know it's an old reference, but like, or Tropic House, like, I just can't stand it. And I'm like, well, you know that it's similar. Like, the closest thing to a fugue we have is like dubstep or tropic. Like, it's a musical statement followed by XYZ, and they're just like, wait, what? And it's like, yeah, you're projecting your enjoyment on other people. I think the other place that I see that a lot is in food, specifically for Adventisms with the veganism is the one I see a lot. And you'll see a lot of people being like, oh, well, it's because you do health and health and health. And it's like, okay, God might be convicting you about that, but he hasn't convicted me yet about that. And beyond that, that's not, you know what I mean? Like, this isn't an issue that's salvific. No, it totally is. It's a sin. Like, I had, and I won't give a name, but I had one of the main, when I was an undergrad, one of the main Ellen White people come in and say, oh, coffee's a sin. And it immediately turned me off to her. Like, and one of a family friend is like good friends with her. And I was like, no, I don't like her anymore. Like, period. Like, anything she says, I'm not going to pay attention to, because I'm like, that might be a problem for you.
Yeah.
It might be a sin for you, but it's not a sin unless God says to you, this really isn't good for you. Just because Ellen White said, it's probably not good for you. If God hasn't said that to you, that's, you're projecting even Ellen White's statements about it onto us as a group, as a whole, a group. So yeah, like you do that. And I think we do these things because it's a self defense mechanism. First off, have you ever heard about the I can't remember the syndrome, but it's like the baby, the hurt chick or the wounded chick syndrome?
No, I haven't.
Chick like baby chicken, not like, yeah, not like Instagram girls. Although it does actually work for Instagram girls as well. So if there is a I don't even know, a flock of chicks born, I don't even know what you would say, a group of chicks that are born at the same time, hatched at the same time. If one is deformed or weak in any way, all the other chicks will gang up on it and peck it to death and kill it. And it's like an instinct. It's a biological instinct. It's not even something, because that one will bring down the rest of the group, and there's a whole thing behind it. But the other thing that we found, that happens in society, which is why I said it actually works for Instagram girls. They found with children in school, they will do that, where as a group, they will find and latch onto and purposely pick on one of these kids, because they sense a weakness and they go, if they are picking on them, they are not picking on me. Even though if nobody picks on anybody, you don't have, you know what I mean? Like, there's another option out there. It's kind of like the Thanos, right? Like, I have to destroy half the earth. Or use that incredible power to make food. Like, I don't understand what the problem is. Like, you can make more food with that. But he's like, nope, I got to destroy everybody. That's the only solution. But that is that kind of thing of that's your own fears and problems, which that's a great, right, projection, right? Thanos,
yes.
If there are any of you, this is going to be nerd. I finally get to nerd out.
Yes, it's
Thanos,
true.
Seeing the destruction of his own planet, then assumes that the only way to avoid that for the rest of the universe is to destroy half of the universe. Rather than stopping and saying, is there any way, rather than dealing with the pain of loss and the fears that he has, which in the comic books, he's just an evil dude. Like, he's not doing this for a good reason. Like, they made him sympathetic in the movies. Don't fall for that.
Which, to be fair, they did a great job.
They did a great job
that.
Oh, no.
Compared to what he is in the comics, they did a fantastic job.
That translated better on film, I will admit, because he becomes one-dimensional as a character if he's just a dude who likes to court death. Which is how they actually started it. He kind of started as this big baddie, and then they like switched it. Anyway, now the point. But it's that idea of he's projecting his own fears and insecurities rather than dealing with it and being like, this is why my society went bad. This is how we can avoid it. He's saying, nope, the only way we can fix this problem is this.
Yeah.
And we see that, I mean, in society so much. This wall. I'm going to get a little political for a second. First off, I just want to say, anyone who thinks a wall is going to stop Mexicans and Hispanics from coming into this country doesn't realize they're already building tunnels. Like, the majority of people who come across are coming through Canada. And the secondary is that they have tunnels.
Yeah. Have you not seen, has no one seen Fast and Furious? There's a whole tunnel chase scene in the border.
And that was Fast and Furious, years ago.
And Fast and Furious is a documentary.
Yeah.
So I don't know.
No,
like,
it's
why.
A real, all those things really happen. hashtag Paul Walker, hashtag too soon. I'm still using hashtag. I don't know what I'm doing here. But that's the reality, is like, it's a self-defense mechanism. So I don't have to deal with my problems, and nobody else can see me. If I project this onto you, now you're the one with the weakness. You're the one with the fear. You're the one with the problems, not me. And I don't have to take a deep look at myself. It's not the only way, but I think that's a big reason why people do that.
Yeah, and I think I think there's another side to this too, where we do this with illegal immigrants in general, or immigration in general, because we'll say, oh, you we'll say that illegal immigrants are the cause of all of our problems. They bring a whole bunch of crime over here. They do all of this stuff, and then you look at any given a statistic on crime, and Americans are arrested and prosecuted and everything else over crimes at a much higher rate, especially the crimes that we accuse illegal immigrants of, or even legal immigrants of, for that matter, right? Tucker Carlson's in the news right now because of not like he's in the news because he's a news anchor, but he's in the news because he's being talked about, because he's become this big shining beacon for white supremacy, because he talks about not just illegal immigration, but immigration in general as a danger.
That was a really good segment about that. Yeah.
Yeah. But I've actually seen this happen too. Now here's the other self-defense one. Ready? We will use projection as a tool to accuse someone else instead of acknowledging our own thing. And black on black crime is the perfect example of this, where white people and I was one of them. So I'm not saying like I am a white person, but I'm saying I'm one of the people that used to do this, and saying, well, if you look at, you know, if you look on black crime, of course, you know, why is racism the enemy when black people, why don't you look at yourselves? And we tell them that they're projecting their own community's crimes and issues onto racism as a whole, and they're deflecting. So they're using racism and social justice as an excuse to not deal with their own problems. And it turns out if you look at those statistics in their context, then you actually find out, oh, wait, no, there's a different story being told here. I actually remember I was sitting in on a conversation once where someone tried to make the point that, you know, it's not because, you know, black people are arrested more because there's a problem where black families don't have as many fathers in the home. There are more families.
Yeah,
I've heard that a lot.
Yeah,
there's more fathers in prison, and it's not the color of your skin that makes you more inclined to crime. It's actually the lack of a father in the household, or the lack of a parent in the household. And he made that statement, and he said, well, and it's just fact that there are more black fathers in prison. I heard that he's like, and it shouldn't be that way, and it sucks that that's the case, but like there are more black fathers in prison, so it makes sense that now there's more crime from the black community. And I love this, the response from the other side of this conversation was, yeah, because you guys put them there. Like, it was this idea of, well, if they're in prison, who put them there? So it was a really interesting thing where, yeah, we use projection as an accusation as well to deflect from having to deal with our own issues. And so self-defense is a huge thing, and it's super subtle, and it takes a whole ton of self-awareness for us to get to the point where we ask ourselves, and I think it takes asking ourselves and going, hey, am I projecting here? Am I guilty of doing the same things, or am I seeing some of the same possible trends? And this is why, like, every single self-awareness thing I ever say on this podcast is predicated and absolutely relies on there being present a true biblical community in your life.
Yeah.
In other words, people that will hold you accountable and call you out when you won't call yourself out. That is, like, straight up, that's what it takes. And so if we cannot rely on ourselves to call ourselves to accountability, we do have to have people around us that can speak truth into our lives when we're trying to avoid it. So that,
we've been talking about, like, what, you know, the reasons to stay in church a lot kind of recently. And, like, to me, that's one of the big reasons. It's not because, like, church is supposed to help with that. Like, and if it's not, all right, then we need to discuss why it's not. But it's like, no. Like, that's exactly why you should be in a church family, because, like, they can do that. They can look and see and get that perspective that you lose, because you've never. There's a comedian who jokes about this, and he's like, I've never seen somebody, and talking about drinking at a house party, he's like, house parties, people get way more drunk than at a bar. People always, the trope is people get super drunk at a bar. He's like, there's maybe one person, but other people can cut you off in a bar. Like other, they know you're there. It's, I, you know, at a house party, you can just drink yourself. You're your own bartender. And he goes, I've never seen somebody cut themselves off too soon. He's like, I'm just seeing somebody go, oh, self, you've reached too much self. Like we're cutting us off. And I'm like, oh, that's such a good point. Like a lot of times we don't have that perspective. And so we just kind of get into an echo chamber and we hear ourselves or even people who agree with us. And so we go to a church that, you know, we'll have people that won't call us out or we don't go to church because we're like, well, they keep calling me out. And I'm not saying that people need to call you out all the time. Like those are people, there's very specific people that should be calling you out. You know what I mean? Like people you've given permission to. We've discussed that a lot of times on this podcast, but it's one of the reasons to have that, like have that community. That's not just going to do that like that's going to happen a little bit on Reddit and other places, but those type of people aren't there to specifically make you try to grow. And church is supposed to be there to make you grow as a Christian. Like that's the community we're supposed to have. And I think the other thing, talking kind of on the flip side about that, where church can be a problem, is that a lot of times people use projection as a means to control people, to keep them in line and to, you do what I want because I need control out of my life, so I'm going to control you by projecting this on you. And I think that is a negative that I see a lot in church, a lot in the Christian community.
And I think that segues perfectly into the flip side of projection as a whole. See, projection, I was a little bit misleading in our operative definition because I wanted to pull this twist out. But it's not just about what's bad for me is bad for everyone. We also use it as a form of what's good for me is good for everyone. And so we do use it as control, and we use it as a tool for control because we project our need for control onto others. But what we do is we say these things are necessary because they were good for me, and now they must be good for you. And you must conform to what was good for me in order for you to be saved. This is what we do with the service. I was thinking about it, man. If you've ever sat when a traditional church takes offering and the deacons walk down the aisles, they hand out the buckets, you know, the offering plates, then they take them up, they stand at the back, everyone stands, we all sing, you know, all creatures here below or whatever, or praise God from whom all blessings flow. That's what we sing as the deacons approach the altar, and then we pray, and then they hand the plates off. And it's like, has anyone ever thought about why we do that? No. Someone was just told at some point, this is how we do this. And then we ascribe a holiness, or we project a holiness onto the tradition or the logistical nature of the behavior instead of why we're doing it. And it turns into this mess of, okay, you must do it this way or it is not holy.
Yeah.
And we do this with
everything down.
What we do, and when we use it as a tool to control, pastors do this a lot too. What we're doing is we're treating tradition as God ordained. We are projecting a God sanctioned thing as something that is, or we're treating something that is man-made as a God sanctioned thing. And it's not. And we confuse the line between the two so often. And it's no wonder people get tired of it, call us out on it, and walk away, right? Like, it's absolutely no surprise to me why people see that and they want no part of it, because it's super obvious if you're not the one doing it. Like, super obvious.
Yeah. I think also we tend to do that. And I'll say on the flip side, pastors also tend to project vision onto a church. And I am very careful about doing this, where a pastor will come in and have their own personal vision or personal issues that they are going through. And they'll be like, everyone must be going through this. We're going to do an entire sermon series on this. And it's like, I don't think the majority of our church is going through this.
Yes.
I think you're going through this right now. And that's... Like, I hate to say it, but like, I've been to some sermons where it's like, that kind of seems like a personal problem to me. Like, why are we talking about this every single time? Like we're supposed to be talking about Ezekiel. How did we end up on veganism again? Like, just, you know, as a joke, but like, it really is like, I, I, I've seen that happen a lot. Or they'll come in and be like, this is what the church needs. We need to be church planning. We need to be doing this. We need to be doing that. And it's like, well, you're projecting a lot onto this community. You don't even really know that community yet. Like, that and might not be what the community needs.
And I've seen it happen, too, where we do this with pastors have done this, too. I've been guilty of this. One person says something and we think everyone represents that opinion. Right. So, pastor, people are saying. Or some person has come to me and told me this was a serious issue. I believed them and said, okay, we need to fix it. Well, no, most people didn't actually care.
The curse of the loud minority.
Yes. So that's been something that's happened too. So projection is huge. It's subtle. And it's this massive enemy that affects individually and affects corporately our lives. And it's really sad too. I think this is why we have dying ministries. Like, you have a church with Pathfinders running or a youth ministry that is dying. And the only reason that it's still running and we keep funding it is because the person running it was adamant that we had to have it because it was good for them. Oh, well, I came up through Pathfinders and it saved my faith, so we have to have one. No, what was good for you was good for you, and I'm glad it was, but that doesn't mean that everyone else has to go through it, or we have to use a ton of money when there's one person in Path, when there's one kid in Pathfinders.
And it's not a bad reason to do it, but it's not the best reason to do it.
Correct.
Like, it's not a good reason. It's a reason, but it's not necessarily like, I want to do it because this was passionate to me. I'm like, cool, you're passionate about it. But don't think that it's going to change every kid, because those are also, you know, we talk a little bit about setting unrealistic expectations. I go, a lot of times when you do those projections in the positive sense or to control, you're setting unrealistic expectations that aren't going to be met.
Yeah. Well, and I think it's been one of the marks of a mature Christian is someone who in board meeting or in any sort of conversation says, hey, is what we've been doing for all this time still effective? In other words, is this still worth doing? Someone who's willing to question the, why or what or if we should keep doing something, I think that marks a lot of maturity and self-awareness to say. And then I will say it marks it, but what proves it is then their willingness to follow through on that question. I think some people ask that as a way to, once again, project this idea of, I'm confident and I am mature, but then if you actually challenge them and push them, they'll go, no, we need to keep this. So it is, they're asking that question with ulterior motives. But we projected onto preachers too. Oh, this is my favorite. Tony, you'll love this because I didn't tell you about this one. I just have it in our notes. I just have it as preachers. When a preacher does something bad, let's talk Bill Hybels, Willow Creek. All these accusations come up on Bill Hybels. And of sexual harassment. And all of a sudden, all these men and women come out of the woodwork going, well, Bill Hybels in the 80s or the 90s or the early 1000s is who converted me to Christianity. There's no way he could do this. There's no way he could, you know, he's such a good preacher, or he's, you know, he was such a good pastor. We do this with abusers. We do this with pastors who lie. We do this with pastors who embezzle to protect them from and protect ourselves. And so we project, once again, what was good for me onto the current situation and refuse to hold people accountable because it was good for me back then. There's no way that's changed now. And so we let pastors walk and get away with a whole lot of stuff just because they were good. They're a good orator.
Or even that at one point in their life, on their journey, they were good. And it's like, just because they were good at one point doesn't mean they can't fall. Like,
yeah,
people can change.
No, absolutely. And that and like that actually is an important point, too, in that someone is capable of doing bad and good at the same time. And I think we like to think, well, if there's no way God would let them preach a sermon And while secretly abusing women or sexually or raping someone or assaulting someone. And I'm like, have you looked at Christian history like at all?
It's right there in the Bible. Like, you have, like, this is the one I always go back to, Balaam. Like, Balaam is blessing Israel and he's a prophet of God. And he's still blessing Israel's enemies at the same time and giving Israel's enemies. All right. So technically I can't curse Israel, but here's how to beat them. Like,
you can do good and bad at the same time.
And he knows that's not good. Like, he knows that this is God's, like people. You know what I mean? Like, I don't know.
Yeah.
Like, I'm with you on that, where it's like, really, really, really?
Yeah, no, and it's so easy to do, and I get why we do it, because the other side of projection is this. Like, can we just be honest? The other side of projection is you don't want to believe that something was a lie for so long. If you have believed something your whole life, if you've been taught that this is the way this is, whether it is with a pastor that you've loved,
yeah,
that has preached amazing sermons and has completely transformed your life with the insights that they had into Scripture, right? You don't want to believe that that person was a terrible person, because you don't want to be duped. You don't want to admit that you were duped. Fully fair. There are a whole ton of people that if I got caught in some scandal or Tony got caught in some scandal, they would go, those guys that host Absurdity? No way. They would, like, they've said so many things that I resonate with, and they've talked about all these serious issues. How could they fall to this? There's no way it's true. And to which I would say, if I'm ever accused of something, I would hope it's not true. and I can't think of anything that I would be accused of currently.
No,
but
for reals.
Like, that's one of those things where we don't want to be duped. We don't want to feel like we've been lied to our whole lives. And so we double down. I love that you talked about that with me. We double down because we want to defend ourselves. We want to control the situation. And we want to, and honestly, we want to put the blame somewhere.
Well, I mean, you see this in society perfectly with Louis C.K. and that whole situation. Kevin Spacey to a degree, but Kevin Spacey kind of never admitted he was a bad person. Like, Louis C.K. built his entire career around being this lovable, I'll say curmudgeon for lack of the word that he uses and accurately describes him, but isn't really a Jesus-y word. He, you know what I mean? Like, he's this very flawed person, and he admits it, and he's very open about it on stage, but because he's doing it in a humorous way, people are like, oh, that silly guy. And then it comes out that he's doing these terrible, terrible things that are not okay, and people double down. Like, he comes out, and he doesn't even really apologize about it, and then he doesn't really take time. And then, like, the whole point, they're like, the whole problem was that he was, and for those of you who don't know, like, basically, he was forcing women to watch him masturbate. And, like, he asked their permission, but he was in a position of power. Like, it was a whole thing. And even though, like, some girls might have enjoyed it, which somebody said, oh, no, it was fine or whatever, like, a lot of these women were not okay with it. And the whole point was it's a control thing. Like, you didn't give them the opportunity or the chance to really say no. And then he shows up randomly at a comedy show, and they're like, you have learned nothing, because again, you just showed up and didn't give the people there a chance to say no. Like, that's the same problem. And people doubled down on him. Comedians doubled down on him, fans doubled down on him. Like, instead of saying, like, this is not okay, like, Louis, you need to back up, they doubled down, and now he's just kind of gone to the left, and they just keep, like, they've gone on this train of insanity, and they're like, well, I've already gone this far, I'm just going to ride this thing out. And it's like, he's doing kind of these worse and worse things. And it's like, more people are saying, like, this is not okay. Why are you defending him? Look, it's not okay. And it's because if I stop now, I have to look at the fact that I was okay with him doing this horrible thing, and I can't do that. So I'm just going to double down. And we do that a lot with pastors. I, you know what I mean? Again, it's that idea of, I don't want to admit that I was duped, or that I don't want to admit that me laughing at this horrible thing wasn't okay, because then I have to feel bad and I have to look at myself and I have to observe myself, instead of just saying, oh, it was a good time. And it's like, no, it's never okay.
One of my favorite moments when I was a theology major that I ever experienced in class was Dr. Tryon.
It was when I was rubbing your beard, right?
Yes.
Yes.
But also, it was in Dr. Tryon's class. And theology majors are the worst about this. Let's be honest. Theology majors are the worst about what I'm about to say. But
Just the worst about just this, period. Worst. Just anything. Anything we're the worst about this. But yes.
Quite literally, yes. No, but I also see this in Adventist Bibles. I see this in Bible studies, too, all the time. Unstructured Bible studies, where we manifest our opinions, and we say, you know, I just think we need to do this. And it's the insertion of the word we. It's this idea of your idea, you're asking, if the church would just do this. And Dr. Tryon called us out and he said, okay, look, I'm tired of this. He was like, if you're going to make a statement about what you think anyone should do, you are not allowed to say we, the church, or any form of any word other than I or me. He was like, if you're going to open your mouth, the only thing you're allowed to say and say what you think we should do, you have to say, I think I should. So I wish the church were more loving. Instead, you need to say, I wish I were more loving. Yeah, I wish the church would take a stand against illegal, you know, against immigration or you know, against whatever, right? I'm going to be fair to both sides of the coin. I wish the church would talk about immigration and protecting our inside. I wish I would. I wish, own your beliefs. Stop putting them onto other people and own them. Because then you can actually dialogue about them. As long as it's all the people out there that are wrong, nothing will change.
Thank you. And beyond that, it was this thing of like, oh man, I wish the church were more friendly. Well, then why aren't you you're the church? Even the fact, like, it was that idea of like not just passing the blame, but like removing yourself from the equation of like, no. Like, have I not chosen you? And I think he specifically mentioned Gideon. I can't remember. Was that Christian spirituality?
Maybe. It was, he said it in multiple classes.
Yeah. But I remember talking like, and he brought up this idea of Gideon, of like, have I not already chosen you? Like, God is, if you're feeling the burden on that, God's probably chosen you to be the solution.
You know, there's a, Tony, you actually have a perfect example of this. And we've talked about it before. I don't know if you've talked about it on the podcast. Visitation.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Remember when members would come up to you and be like, Pastor, you haven't visited me in a while.
Well, yeah, like, okay, so I got to talk about my idea. Okay, so my concept, when I talk about visitation, I'm talking about the specific where the pastor goes on rounds every week. And my thing, like, we were told at, when we were at Southern by almost every professor, like, that's the number one thing, that's the number one thing, that's the number one thing, that's the number one thing. Like, that was the number one thing all the time.
And I remember actually a student came up to me once and was like, hey, so you're a pastor now, right? How soon after you got into your district did you start doing visitation?
Yeah. Like, and it's like, okay, so to me, that doesn't work in, if that's, all right, and I will say this, if that's your personality, by the way, if you're a visitor, if you're a social guy who wants to get out and meet people or like a church planter, that's great. Go for it. Like, if that's your strength, I'm not knocking that as your strength. It's a tool. But that is one of the ways, and I have seen, and I have spent a lot of time around pastors, that is one of the number one reasons for burnout, is visitations. Because it takes a ton of time, and you're going around, and it's time you're away from your family. You can, board meetings and committees are another one. That's another big one. But you can hand off committees, right? No one really says anything. Maybe you have to chair a specific individual, like a specific meeting, but you can hand off a committee to somebody, you know, an elder, a deacon, even if it's a low enough, you know, committee and just be like, hey, you chair this. I don't need to chair this. And it's actually, in my opinion, smarter sometimes. Sometimes you have to, but if you have a strong elder, it's smarter to do that because they're going to be there. You know, you're probably on the move. They're going to be there for a while. And they know the context and know the people better. Anyway, point being, you can't really hand off quote unquote visitation. So I would have members come up to me and be like, well, haven't, you know, like, how come you haven't been around? And I'm like, oh, are you lonely? Who have you visited? We have 300 members on the books, 200 that actually attend, like 250 that would attend. We were pretty decent. We actually had 80%. We had a pretty decent percentage, but I'm like, we have a ton of people. If you're feeling lonely, go visit somebody. Like, if you want me around because you're dealing with something, that's a different conversation. Like, I have training to help where other people don't. But if you're just lonely, go visit somebody. Well, you're the pastor and you're a church member. Like, my role isn't, yes, you want to get to know people. And this is where a lot of people, you can't until you get to know them. And I go, we have social events. We have Bible studies. I was in that building almost 7 days a week. Because of they had a school there and I would teach a class. And so somebody would be like, oh, I never see you. And I'm like, well, I'm here every day. Where are you? Where's your responsibility in all of this? Why is the onus on me to go out? And beyond that, nowadays, it's impossible. Try to just show up at a millennial's house First off, yeah, they're probably out eating. We don't, millennials don't cook a lot. And second,
I don't even have any groceries in my fridge right now or in my house. I have nothing. I have seasonings and that's about it. I legit have not. And part of that's because I'm going on a trip this week and I don't go grocery shopping right before I'm about to be out of town.
Millennials travel a lot for jobs.
Yeah. No, you're right.
Like legit. Like that's the thing is that a lot of times we struggle trying to find jobs that work with us or whatever, or visitations because we're either in school or we're moving around or we're not used to visitation. And so it's like back in the day, you could almost get away with doing the visitation because it's like, I'm going to visit Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and I'm just going to go and meet three people or four people today. And 4 hours a day, you can do that. I could do 4 hours, but I'm like, it's a whole process with millennials and yeah. Forget, you know, Gen Zers, any really meta modern, anybody that came after Gen X, like it's, and even Gen X, like 40, 50 year olds, like it's kind of hard to visit them too. So, cause they were latchkey kids, like they're not used to that kind of always having food ready in the home. So like, it's a difficult thing. And so that's my whole thing is like, well, where's your responsibility? If you're lonely, go visit somebody. And they would come in like, oh, the elders need to do better to visit. And I'm like, no, the elders need to do better caring for our people. We need to create a culture of visitation. Because if we're going to be a church, like to me, and this is my own personal thing, like God wants however many people in your city to be Adventists, not Seventh-day Adventists, but Adventists, ready for his second coming. If we believe our message, if we actually believe the things that we talk about, if certain large leaders high up in the administration actually believed it, then we would be like, we're not okay with 20% growth. I was in a town of 60,000 people. We needed a plan to reach 60,000 people. Yeah. Like, how do we reach 60,000 people? Because that's the amount of people God wants us to reach. We can't, the pastor can visit 60,000 people. Like, we have to create this culture if you're going to think bigger. If you're cool being a 50-member church and that's all you really want to do and you just talk about evangelism and growth, you don't actually want to believe it, then yeah, have the pastor visit everybody. But if you actually want to grow, you have to create a culture of, and that's an idea of projecting the responsibility and the blame on leadership rather than owning it, and we do that back. My thing was oh man, my church would grow so much if they would just catch the vision. And it was like, looking back, I was like, oh, why didn't, like, I didn't give the vision. Like, I didn't project it well enough. Not project it. I didn't present it well enough so that people could catch it. Like, the problem wasn't with them. The problem was with me.
And you and I have done this on this podcast several times. I can think of I Don't Like Church, that episode, just 4 episodes ago.
Oh, yeah.
We talked about churches being bad at young adult ministry. We talked about, you and I haven't been to every church. We've been in the Southern Union pretty close.
Okay, like, we've been to a lot.
But that's my point. Then we talk about the division as if it's all the South. But there's this idea of, okay, well, they're bad at the form of young adult ministry that we like. Yeah. But actually, there's a lot of young adults that are in their churches and they're perfectly content and happy with what's happening.
I wouldn't say that. The numbers don't show a lot, but yeah,
a lot is a general number. I'm not going to say there's 3,000 of them or 10,000 or whatever. I'm just going to say there's young adults,
7,000 who have not bent the knee.
Okay, but that's my point. We say we project what's good, what we think young adult ministry should be. We think every church should do.
Right,
and there are young adults sitting in church going, actually, I'm fine with what my church is doing. Yeah. I don't need your thing. So why? What makes your thing better than my thing? Is it the numbers?
Yeah.
Because I'm pretty sure Jesus said narrow is the way, and few there be. Yeah. Like, so there's this.
So
same deal. But then they do it to us too. I get it. But I'm just saying, I'm not trying to say like, oh, everyone else is terrible for projecting because we've never done that.
No, we do that on this podcast totally do that
all the time.
But I think that's the other thing about projection, that a lot of times you it happens. Because you only know your experience.
Yes.
But I think also be careful with the line. There's a difference between projection and, I just had the word. Where you like take the data and you make a educated guess, but there's an actual word for
prediction?
Yes, prediction. there's a difference between that. Like when you look at the data and you say, okay, this is what is showing, we can accurately summarize and predict, like, this is what's happening.
We can make a projection for the future.
We can either make a projection. Like, I'm not projecting that the church is bad with young adults. The numbers are telling us the church is bad with young adults. But that doesn't mean that every church, like, the difference is me saying every church is bad with young adults versus there's something wrong and we need to fix it because this is what the numbers are saying. Yeah. The difference between a pastor saying we need to pick a sermon series based on what our people are struggling with, and I'm struggling with this, everybody must be struggling with this, this is what we're going to be preaching on. You know what I mean? Yeah. And same thing in Bible studies and things like that. Like, talk to your people. Know what is it that you're struggling with? And sometimes you can kind of know for them. I'm not saying that everyone has their own answer. Sometimes you can kind of see and be like, this is what they're struggling with. But the difference is, don't project what's you on them. And the difference is, like, the motivation to me, it's also it. I grew up in a church that struggled with our youth and young adults, but was like close to a church that did well with it. So I grew up in a decent system. It wasn't great, but it was decent. But then there was a lot of problems and people left. And so where I was at, if I were to say, well, all the churches in this conference suck because my experience, and I don't want people to look at my church, then that's projection. But if I say, look, growing up, the majority of the people that I grew up with are no longer in the church.
Yeah.
That's prediction. That's, you know, that's summarizing that's just saying, and evaluating. That,
like, that's just analyzing. Yeah,
that's analyzing. And it's like, look, this is an analysis of the data. Like, so you do, like, sometimes you need to be careful, but at the other times it's like, well, this is a problem. But don't remove yourself from that equation. That's the difference. Like, when you're removing yourself from it.
I think this is a good point to end on to what you're talking about, because I think we can lean too far the other direction on projection. We think it's so bad that we stop dreaming about what the church could be, about what we could be, about the things that we could do and accomplish. I heard it said that the difference between conservatives and liberals is that conservatives or traditionalists see the kingdom of God as something that is coming, whereas liberals or progressives see the kingdom of God as something that can be partially realized here on earth now. So, like, we talk about kingdom living now, and I've heard it said that way, and it's obviously an overgeneralization, but it's kind of this idea that sometimes we let our beliefs stop us from dreaming about what we could be, about who we could be, and I think progressives do the same thing, even though that overgeneralization still exists. I think we can all do the same thing. We're not saying that every statement you make about what the church could be or should be or has done is wrong. We're not saying that you're wrong for holding it. I just think there's a place for self-awareness here. But we should absolutely be dreaming together about, I love Joel 2, where it's, you know, your young men will dream dreams and your young women will see visions. And this idea that we, I was listening to a sermon by Tim Gillespie yesterday, which is kind of where this whole term came from. And it was this idea that, you know, not everyone's called to be a prophet, but you are speaking prophetically whenever you are dreaming about what the future could be and look like for the church. In the same way that the prophets would always call out, like, if you do this, we would all be good. If you would repent, we would all be good. They're dreaming and they've been shown by God.
This is the problem.
They've been shown a reality by God that could exist for the people of God if the people of God would do X. That's what they've been shown. Yeah. And so they're talking about those. And it's the same thing. We can dream and be hopeful and optimistic about what the future can bring and what we could make the future working alongside God. And sometimes I think we would also err on the side of letting our projecting or our fear of projecting stop us from those big dreams, stop us from making predictions, and stop us from the prophetic reality that even Seventh-day Adventism, especially Seventh-day Adventism, has been called to.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think that that's an important thing is don't use it to tear down. If you're using your vision to tear down, that's the problem. But keep dreaming. Like, if you want to project something positive into somebody's life, like not what's good for them, not as a way to control, not as a way to tear them down. But if you're like, dude, I can absolutely see you being incredible. Help them realize that vision, because again, you're not removing yourself from the equation. You're putting yourself in there. And that's the other key with dreams, is that if you're seeing something that can be, most of the time you're passionate and you want to see that and you're going to get involved. Like, very rarely do I see anybody who's really like passionate and has a vision for something, and then it's like, this is so amazing for that guy over there. I'm going to sit down and wait for, like, normally it's like, how can I make this happen? And if that's happening in your church, like, don't hate on somebody who is projecting, because that tells you more about them. Just know that that is happening and be self-aware so that you're not doing it. But then also don't be afraid to have visions and dreams for the future. But just make sure to keep yourself as part of that solution.
Absolutely. I think that's a great place to end. So I'm going to cut it there. Thank you guys so much for listening to Absurdity. I really hope that you enjoyed this episode, got something out of it. You can find our contact info down in the show notes. It has both of our Twitter handles, has my email. And you're more than welcome to reach out with any sort of feedback. As is tradition, negative feedback goes to Tony, positive feedback goes to me.
Yay!
That way I always think that I'm doing great. It's just a way to feed my ego, really. Thank you guys for listening. And, you know, if parts of this episode were uncomfortable, we apologize. It's just us being real and honest. That's what Absurdity is about. We hope that, you know, this was something that could benefit you. If you want to donate and support us financially, you can head over to patreon.com/absurdity podcast. All patrons get ad-free episodes, and $5 or more patrons get bonus episodes at least once per month. Tony is working on some awesome interviews where we're diving into kind of personal stories and journeys and sharing those. And any extra seminars and teachings that we do will also be available there. And you can find us on iTunes, Stitcher, any podcatching app, Spotify. A lot of people are listening to us on Spotify currently. So thank you guys so much for your support. Without you, there is no Absurdity. We have some awesome goals and awesome things coming in 2019. We really want to hit an average of 2,000 downloads per episode. We're regularly breaking 2,000 now, but I want to hit that as the average by June. So share this with a friend. Let people know that this is happening. We love you. We thank you so much for being a part of this. Tony, I'm so glad you're a part of this as well. It's so cool to be doing this alongside someone that I consider really a brother. It means the world. So thank you, guys. We'll see you next week.